and welcome to the Sunday Salon, the podcast that celebrates brilliant books and the women who write them. This was such a joyous conversation. Jessica Fellows is a journalist and the author of 10 books, ranging from Mud in the City, Do's and Don'ts for Townies in the Country, to her wildly successful series of Mitford Murders books, which fuse historical fact and fiction. Our conversation was as varied and quirky as that output suggests, and I loved hearing about her most recent novel, The Mitford Trial, as well as how her deafness has informed her writing, working with her uncle Julian Fellows on the Downton Companion books, and touring the world as a result, how lockdown has affected her creativity, and why writing tips are mostly useless. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Jessica, welcome to the Sunday Salon. It's such a pleasure to have you on.
It's really nice to be here, Alice. Thank you.
So I've got lots of questions for you, as you know, but I wonder if I can just start by asking you a little bit about what this year has been like for you. I mean, this is presumably the first time you've ever launched a book in lockdown. So how has your whole experience of the sort of our year of lockdown and non-lockdown and isolation how's that been?
It's definitely gone up and down. I mean, I do feel, first of all, I feel I'm one of the very, very lucky ones because I live in the country. So the first lockdown was actually really, although it was very weird, the feeling of everyone being in it together was quite helpful. And then we were in our house in Oxfordshire and the weather was gorgeous, and my stepson was with us and my mother-in-law was with us, as well as my 10-year-old son, and we just got a second big dog, and so we kind of had that holiday feel. We ate outside every day and we just enjoyed the garden, and we were just incredibly grateful to be in our particular situation. I have found the second lockdown oddly more difficult. I don't know whether that's because I thought I was going to go into it feeling absolutely fine, and then I sort of didn't. And I thought I had mentally prepared myself for the fact that this is going to be a long winter, and then it feels like I just haven't. I find that I'm really missing everyone a lot now. But, I mean, I have been very productive this year, which has been kind of strange as well, because, I mean, I definitely, the first 2 weeks of the first lockdown, I couldn't concentrate at all, and I was really grateful that I had just finished my novel before lockdown started. And I took on an extra piece of work that I wouldn't normally have done, because I just saw a year of not much happening and not much travel, and I just worried about economically if a recession came. I had to weather the one in 2008 before, for various reasons. My husband's business crashed then, and I was in journalism, and it all just sort of started plummeting down the chute, and you know, everything sort of changed. And so we did feel quite resilient from that point of view, quite prepared. But I did know then that you sort of everything is fine, and then the work starts to slope off quite quickly. So I thought I'd better take some extra work on. So I have done. I've written a novella, and I've written a television script, and I'm working on another non-fiction book proposal at the moment, and I'm starting the next Mitford murder book. So because I do know how to work from home, I've just maintained that discipline, but it has been quite difficult at times. Even when you're feeling really lucky, it feels quite difficult. So, you know, so I really, for those who are finding it tough, I just think it's, you know, it's extraordinary how many people have managed to adapt and cope as well as they have. And it's really hard. A lot of writers, I think, expected to be able to do lots of writing in this period, but it's quite difficult to focus when your brain is fizzing all the time between, oh, I'm working at home, oh my god, everyone's about to die, or oh, I feel like I'm on holiday, or oh, I'm really under pressure, you know, just constantly going backwards and forwards all the time and never really being able to settle into one feeling of okay, this is how it is, and this is how it is. Everything's very unpredictable, and that makes everything feel uncertain, and I think that makes it very difficult to focus.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, because you mentioned what a productive year you'd had. You're probably the first person this year who's come on this podcast and said as much. And I wondered, how do you cope with, I suppose, the distraction of kind of major world events and social media and the temptation to kind of doom scroll and the kind of breaking news? Do you have a way of blocking that out? Do you have a sort of conscious way of doing that?
No, other than I think just generally, I mean, I get very frustrated that I think I'm a real old faffer. And I've just learned that my process involves 3 to 4 hours of faff beforehand. And no matter what I try to do to cut that down, I just don't seem to be able to. So I get, you know, my husband runs a business. He gets up to his desk and he's just boom, 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 ticking off all those things on the to-do list, getting it done, making those phone calls. And the way we sit, it's quite funny. We share an office and he says, I've set it up like an exam invigilator. So I'm behind him so that I can see him on his screen, but he can't see me on mine. And I actually do that sometimes quite embarrassing thing, as if he was my boss, when he comes over and stop hastily changing what's on my screen so he can't see that I've been doom scrolling or shopping or whatever, making it look like I've actually been writing some words, which inevitably I haven't been. I mean, the actual writing that happens in a day is probably an hour and a half to get my word count, but the sort of staring out of the window, the shopping, and the only thing I can think of that it is that, because I do in the end achieve quite a lot, so I think it must be doing something, it's a kind of need to calm my brain down and just download, so I just look at more and more idiotic things so that I'm not really thinking anything. And I've got quite a large beauty section on my desk, so there's a lot of nail polishing that goes on, and there's a bit of tweezering that goes on, and you know, you're just sort of generally sort of retidying and staring out. But I don't go downstairs, I don't telephone anyone, I don't engage in too much communication with anyone else.
That's interesting.
And I do, and you know, and I do look at all the news if I just do give into it sometimes, but I have gone through various processes of trying Freedom Apps or locking my telephone in a drawer 3 floors down so that I don't go and look at it and things. But I actually in the end I've just sort of realized that this is the way that I do it. So I get up, I do the school run, I do some exercise, I come upstairs with my second cup of coffee and allow myself to just be quite silly for a couple of hours, just think of as many insignificant things as I need to, until suddenly I start to get bored with myself and start wanting to get into the story. And the one thing I have found quite helpful actually is I'd signed up, I was going to do an Arvon writing course that got cancelled because of COVID, which I was really disappointed about. And so I got my deposit back and I used the money to sign up to masterclass.com. And sometimes if I to get myself in the mood, I'll watch 2 or 3 masterclass lessons. And that will sort of start making me think, oh, yes, I want to try that method out, or I want to try doing something, you know, sort of, oh, yes, I think I can do that. And that can sometimes shortcut it a little bit. But, you know, otherwise, usually it's I look up at the clock and realise my son's going to be home in a couple of hours. I better do something. And then the deadline kicks in. But I think you just need that. You need to remove yourself slowly from serious thoughts.
So just 2 quick follow-ups before I move on that. First of all, you mentioned your word count. I just wondered what your daily word count was. And secondly, you mentioned watching masterclasses. Mm. Do you mean specifically writing ones?
Yes.
Well, you should be giving them.
But, but there's always things to learn. And also because I've been doing script writing this year. So it's been a new form of writing.
Yes.
But I love hearing about other writers' processes. I think because everybody does do it differently, and you want to imagine that there's some silver bullet and someone's going to say to you, so what I do is I sit down at my desk at this particular time and then it happens. And it's just, it isn't like that. I've now learned it just isn't like that. I've tried all sorts of other writers' procedures and you can't borrow it from them. You have to find your own way in the end. You do get some useful tips. I mean, there are certain things like just keeping on going. Don't go back. I mean, somebody told me, if you can't think of a word, just write XXX and carry on. And that was really helpful. Write a piece out of sequence. If you get up to a chapter and you really can't write that chapter, then just skip it for the moment. I rarely do it, but you can just skip it and just go on to the one that you do want to write. I quite often will think about the scene I'd rather be writing, and that will help unlock other things. Adele Parks gave me a brilliant piece of advice, which was to interview your own characters before you start writing the novel, which is fantastic, which is a great way of unlocking their voice and what they really think about it. something and you keep it on one side, and you inevitably find that you use some of that interview later on in the book. 20-minute timers are quite good. Just 20 minutes. Don't allow yourself to stop. And then do, I mean, what you forget is that you think you're not doing anything, but it actually is using a huge amount of concentration to really focus on this completely imaginary world, particularly in a year when somebody else has said, you know, the real world has competed with the imaginary world in terms of extreme situations. And you can always learn, even if you're not going to be able to exactly copy another writer. I think it's still really helpful to hear what they've done. And then for daily workout is, I when I'm really in the swing of writing a novel, I aim for around 1500 words a day. I'm happy if I've done that. Occasionally you get that freak day where you do 3000 words and you go, my God, this is amazing. If I do this every day, the whole thing is going to be done in 6 weeks. And in fact, I remember with my first novel, I wrote 10,000 words really super fast, and I called up my editor and said, do you know what, you can just redo the whole schedule, this is all going to be done super early. he said okay, and just sort of hung up, and I said, well, and then of course, and it just didn't work, you know, the whole thing had to be rewritten, and those 3,000 words exhaust you and you can't do it again for another week. But around 1500 words, I would say, is about right. And then sometimes, you know, sometimes a bit less. But you have to be a bit careful, I think, about being a slave to a word count, because sometimes you need to spend a day not adding your word count, but really thinking about your plot, or really thinking about a character, or researching a situation, and just remind yourself you're not falling behind. It's okay. You're getting somewhere. And I can be a bit addicted to, I use a software tool called Scrivener. And I think it's great, but I'm a little bit addicted to watching the progress bar sort of improve.
Right.
I'm pathetically sort of always messing around with the deadline, so it looks like I'm doing slightly better than I am, and things, you know. So you can set a deadline date and how many words you need to write for the whole project, and how many words you want to write per day, and you know, it can be quite motivating. But I think there are times when actually I would be better off saying it's not happening today and going for a walk to just relax myself, or to read something different, or, you know, think about something different or whatever.
You said quite a few things there that I'm probably going to come back to and ask you more about, but I wonder if I could just rewind and ask a little bit of background to start with. Can you tell me about your childhood and where you, I suppose, where you found an interest in both reading and writing, but also sort of period writing, history. I read somewhere that your grandfather used to tell you incredible stories. I'd love to hear about your childhood and where that interest came from.
I mean, I think first of all, I was a reader long before I was a writer. I was a big reader from a pretty early age. That was partly because I'm deaf, and so and the hearing aids that I had when I was a child were pretty hopeless, analog hearing aids, and quite unwieldy, and it was fine, you know. My parents were incredibly encouraging, and it was always sort of not seen as a problem, but I think nevertheless it was quite an effort to be listening to people, and I loved just curling up on the sofa or on my bed and just spending hours and hours reading. So I used to read a lot, but it didn't particularly occur to me that I would be a writer. It was not the path I set out for myself at all, really, for ages. And the period drama, it partly was my grandfather. I think it was, I mean, I was brought up by two very bohemian parents in Southeast London. My mother is an actress and my father is an artist, and they were very deliberately sort of rejecters of their own particular backgrounds, but they were still close to their parents, and we used to go and spend time with them. And my grandmother on my mother's side was a great storyteller of tall tales rather than sort of proper worked out folk thing. But she used to tell fantastic stories, and she was very glamorous and had obviously been very naughty and married three times and had endless lovers, and would tell me stories about men locking her in rooms and threatening to shoot them if she didn't agree to marry them, and all this sort of thing. It all sounded incredibly thrilling. And then on my father's side was my grandfather, who was always very interested in history. His wife, who had almost no education and was frightfully posh, but adored history. But she would talk about them like they were people. So I went and stayed with them when I was writing my history A-level, because I knew she would be absolutely perfect, and she was. I would say, so what can you tell me about Louis the 12th of France? Louis! Oh, he went off. He had the most marvellous time. I must tell you about when he got married. It was, you know, like she was telling me gossip from someone who lived in the village next door, and it made it all really real. And I think I really had that sense that history wasn't this dry set of dates. It was people who had lived lives and were not really very different from us, except that they just lived in a different time. So I think that probably stirred that side of things up. But it was really my friendship with my father's younger brother, Julian, who obviously most people know as Julian Fellowes and creator of Downton Abbey. But he and I used to talk a lot. He was quite a young uncle when I was born, and he didn't have any children, didn't get married till I was 16. So I was his surrogate daughter for quite a long time. And we'd go on holidays together and things, and stay with other families and kids. And we just spent a long time talking about all the family stories, which he had been very interested in himself as a young man. And when he was a young man, there were all these extraordinary great aunts around the place. The most famous one in our family being Izzy Stevenson, who was presented to Queen Victoria in 1898 and then re-presented to King Edward VII when she got married, and had a butler. And you know, she used to tell all these stories to Julian. And then it was all sort of real then. And she died in 1976, and then he told all the stories to me. So I think that's what got me started on all that period. And then it all kind of came together because I would read all of the novels and the authors of the 1920s and 1930s. That's always kind of been my bag. Mm. So we've had that in common. So it created this really nice symmetry in a way, where we've both ended up working a little bit together and a little bit in the same sort of field. He sometimes tells people that we both started our writing career at the same time, which is not a comparison I like much, because he's one better. I've not got there yet.
You initially went into journalism. Hmm. Can you tell me how that came about, and kind of, I suppose, what your time, your early days in journalism were like?
Yeah, they were different. Well, I didn't know what to, I floundered. I took a couple of years out after school because my mother was ill and I didn't really know which way to turn. And so I got to university quite late, and then accidentally chose a 4-year course because I went to Scotland. So I was quite old by the time I came out. I was 24. By the time I finished all that university stuff. And the dream I had was to be a barrister. And I'd realised that I just wasn't really clever enough. So I just didn't know what to do. I did a series of odd jobs. This was 1998. There was a bit of a recession going on at the time. I remember being quite difficult to get work. And then I did find a bit of a job. And then my mother's greatest friend lived next door to a woman called Christina Appleyard, who was then editor of the Mail on Sunday supplement, Night and Day magazine, as it was then. And she said, I'll give you a job for 6 months. I said, well, that's amazing. And she said, no, I'm going to treat you like something on the bottom of my shoe and give you, the very worst job to do, but it'll be something to put on your CV. And it was an incredibly tough environment, the Mail on Sunday at that time. But, I ended up working there for on and off for 6 years. I kind of went away in the middle of it and went back again. And initially, I was really only there doing the photocopying and covering her PA. And I did quite a lot of work on the picture desk, which I really enjoyed. I loved helping set up photo shoots. And in those days, if you wanted to get somebody, if somebody was being interviewed, the journalist would say to you, they need all the information. So you would go off down the corridor to the cuttings room, and this bloke would kind of go off into depths of some enormous cupboard and bring back a little brown manila envelope with all the cutout articles of that person that existed. And then you would come back, you'd go through them all and find out the interesting bits of information, and then try to track down interesting photographs that might exist. You know, you couldn't just, there was email a bit, but there really wasn't internet at that time. So we were really at the end of that kind of old journalism time. And we had an absolute whale of a time. And it was quite funny. I was working, sort of, when I went back the second time, there was Celia Walden was there, who's a journalist now at the Telegraph, one of my greatest friends. And we were working there together. And, you know, everybody kept saying to us, the older ones kept saying, oh, you've really missed the good days of journalism.
Yes.
And amazing. And we'd all have 4-hour lunches and nobody really did any work. And we all went out drinking every night. And, you know, and you're having a rotten time. Because we look back now and think, well, we had a really lucky time. And we weren't paid very well, but you're always given a pretty good expenses account. And we were pretty naughty. I mean, we used to go, Celia and I did a party column for about a year. We got very thin because we didn't really eat anything except canapés and champagne. And then we would get the night bus home, but we would fake taxi receipts for our expenses, and that's how we would bump up our wages a little bit. You know, get yourself an extra 50 quid or something that way. It was a sort of what everyone was doing, which is why when all the journalists exposed all the MPs' expenses, it did make you think, really, you know, come on. But mind you, we weren't building any duck houses with our expenses, but you know, it was good. I think we had a lot of fun, actually. I think we had a lot of fun. I mean, we had a lot of press trips and things. It was great.
You mentioned being deaf. How did that affect things when you were buzzing around town, kind of going to parties, doing interviews, and also, I suppose, how has it informed your writing now? I wondered if you thought it had affected your role as an observer, if you felt that you were perhaps attuned to particular things any more than you might have been otherwise.
I think I was a pretty hopeless journalist. I think, you know, I mean, I always found interviews quite uncomfortable things. And I don't know if that was partly because that was the Mail on Sunday approach. I remember having a bit of an argument with my deputy editor at one point. I was saying, I don't understand why you've asked this other journalist to do that particular interview. Their writing is so terrible. And she said, oh my God, you just don't get it, do you? It's not about the writing. What is it about? You know, what is it you want then? She said, we want you to get them either to tell you a secret that they've never told anyone, not even their best friend, or we want you to get them to slag someone else in their industry. And that's it. If you get one of those two things, you've done a great interview. We've got the headline. I just was not that person. I just couldn't really do that. And I was very uncomfortable with it. And even at the parties, you'd have to go up to people and ask them things. And then, of course, the minute you told them you were from Mail on Sunday, you just immediately were subject to a barrage of abuse. And I remember the worst was Bridget Jones. Helen Fielding gave a book launch for Bridget Jones, and there were masses of writers there that I really liked, Nick Hornby and Sebastian Faulks and all this sort of thing, and there's just nobody would talk to me. I was fangirling over all of them, saying, you know, I love your books, and they'd say that's very nice, and then I'd say, well, we have to, I'm from them, something. What, you know, and then they wouldn't talk to me, and I thought, this is just humiliating, this is awful, I've got to kind of get out of here. Anyway, but the deafness was also not really helping the situation, because I kind of, particularly at the parties, I would find it difficult. But that's why I used to do it with Celia, really. We would sort of stand there together. She would talk to them and she would say what they'd said, and I'd sort of write it down, and was between us, we would cobble it together. Although it was always a very gentle column. We only ever had one person, I think, say that they didn't like what we said, which was rather worryingly, it was Paul McCartney, and we took it to the department, and they said, well, he's got more money than the Mail on Sunday, so you better work something out quick. But I think from, in terms of more generally being a writer, being deaf has definitely helped, or it's something I've worked with and turned it to my favour, whichever way you want to look at it. But I think I do watch people. I mean, I think when you think about the fact that when you're in communication with someone, I mean, like today, we're doing this podcast. I know most people are listening to it, but I've asked us to be on Zoom concurrently. And for me, there's something very helpful, not just about being able to lip read you, but just to be able to see you as you talk to me, and probably for you to see me as I talk to you. There's all kinds of things one picks up on that are nothing to do with the words that are spoken. And when that goes, I find it really difficult. I miss that human face interaction a lot. And you know, I love WhatsApp video and Zoom, and I've been asking, you know, I've always done Skypes and things long before anyone else has done. I'm not a big fan of the phone. So I hope that comes through in my writing. I hope what I'm able to do is demonstrate something of the communication. Having said that, my favourite bit of writing is dialogue. And I think it's something that I can do. That slightly chatty, easy form of dialogue. But I can't put that down to my deafness or anything, except that maybe I have to listen harder. So maybe I do. Maybe I hear more when I'm listening harder.
You mentioned there that your favourite bit of writing is dialogue, which does, it sort of brings me something I want to discuss with you, which is how you go about researching your novels and sort of fusing the real with the invented, or, you know, the imagined. And I, particularly given that you said earlier you kind of interview your characters, of course, that's sort of interviewing real people. Before you even start that process, do you kind of immerse yourself? Do you do lots of research? Do you do lots of sort of research as if you were, I suppose, writing a non-fiction book or a journalistic piece? Or do you actually prefer to just stand back and let your imagination run wild?
I do quite a lot of research, but there is a point at which I have to free myself from that. And I'm always battling slightly with research, because for a very long time, I mean, I'm now about to write what is my fifth novel, and I've written a novella as well, so my sixth really. Though, and so I'm getting more comfortable with that, but definitely one of the hardest points about the transition from non-fiction to fiction was the fact that you're allowed to make stuff up. You sort of forget that. And I think with these books, what I'm really looking at is not, I'm not writing biographies. There are some brilliant biographies out there. And one of my favourite things is when people say to me they've read the books and they've gone off and they've been inspired to find out more about the Mitford sisters, or more about, you know, Alice Diamond, or, you know, whatever. And so I'm thrilled about that. But what I'm looking at is the gaps in between the facts, if you like. I'm interested in what gets them from one place to the other, or how would they have reacted if I put them in this particular kind of situation. And so I like to put in authentic detail. I think it's important that you trust the context of the writing, but you have to free yourself from that at a certain point. And David Nichols, who I like very much, I've met a few times, and he's a really, really nice man. And he said you should use the research, you know, after you've written it, to kind of bolster whatever you've written. Don't write to the research, which I thought was, you know, which is a really clever thing to do. And the fact is, actually, to be honest, most things have happened. I mean, for the most recent book, The Mitford Trial, I would sort of think to myself, well, what I really need to know is, did such a thing exist as a very high up Nazi officer who betrayed his country? And you sort of Google it, you know, and up pops someone, you know, two or three probably. And you can sort of almost always find something in history to support a direction that you want to go in. It's interesting with the series of the Mitford sisters. It's almost getting more challenging as it goes on, because they wrote themselves quite a lot about who they were and what they did. And I can't copy that. I mean, legally, I can't copy that. But also, there's no point in copying that. You know, we're creating fictional dramas here. So it's kind of trying to look at it from a different angle. And then you just have to allow yourself to put them in whatever clothes you want, and just, you know, just not worry about it. They do have to be stories, first and foremost. I think that's what I have to keep in mind.
What was it that first attracted you to writing about the Mitfords in particular?
Well, it was the idea actually came from Ed Wood at Little Brown, who's now the publishing director of Sphere, the crime imprint at Little Brown. And he came up with the concept of a vintage crime series featuring the Mitford sisters, with each book focusing on a different sister. So he approached me and asked if I would be interested in writing that series. And it was just amazing timing. I'd finished the Downton books. I wasn't quite sure what to do next. I'd started writing another novel. But, I'd been a working writer for such a long time. I need a commission. I need a deadline. I need to know, you know, there's a paycheck at the end of it. You know, I'm really hugely admiring of people who manage to go off and write novels without any of that to motivate them. And he was just, I thought it was a great concept. I got it immediately. I knew that I wanted to write a novel in the 1920s and 30s, and he was there to help me, you know, to learn my way through the kind of crime aspect of it. I thought two things really. First of all, I thought when I submit to him my first bit, if he says to me, the characters are great, I know who they are, but the plot really doesn't work, that's fine. If he says to me, the plot is brilliant, but I just don't believe anyone who's in it, then it's over for me, because they are two totally different parts to writing a book. And I do think plotting is something that you can learn, and it's definitely something that you get better at, and it's almost objectively something that works in one particular way or not, whereas but bringing characters to life is something I think you can either do or you can't as a writer. All writers improve, but it's the Stephen King line: you can't make anyone a great writer, only great writers are great writers. The greats exist in a whole strata up above us. And you can't make a bad writer a competent writer, but you can make a competent writer a good writer. There is room to improve. And then the second thing I thought about the commission with the Mitford murders was that none of the sisters themselves were nice enough to really carry readers through an entire series. So I had to have a fictional character. I had to have someone that I wanted to spend 6 years with, which is ultimately what it's going to be. So that's why I have my protagonist Louisa Cannon and Guy Sullivan, because I wanted to spend time with them. And so that also was great, because they just allow me to do all the really fictional stuff that I can't make any of the Mitford sisters do. I can give it all to Louisa instead.
You mentioned the Downton companion books. I mean, I wanted to ask you about that, because it was such a huge phenomenon. I mean, it was a giant international juggernaut, and and you found yourself becoming a sort of in-demand speaker and authority on the whole phenomenon and subject as well. What was that like? I mean, did you anticipate that? And also, was it completely welcome, or was it sort of at times where you were a bit like, leave me alone about the Downton thing now?
I think it would be very ungracious to be ungratefully anything but grateful for Downton, because it really did it transform my life in terms of the opportunities that it gave me. And it was incredible. It was extraordinary to be in on the inside and in this slightly peculiar position that I was in, which is that I was nothing to do with anything in terms of the creation and success of Downton. You know, the show was 100% written by Julian, and the producers and the crew and the actors and everything who worked on it. I mean, they did a phenomenal job. So I just had a real front row seat watching it. What was really bizarre was when I went to America and started doing the speaking tours. So what I would always do is, you know, the actors and everything, they do all the stuff in New York and LA. I'd go where no one else would go. So I go to the real Midwest. I loved it. I spent 5 years. I've always had a fascination with America. And I really went to those places that you would never go to on holiday. You might at a push, I guess, if you were doing a real coast-to-coast drive or something. But most people do not see the America that Americans think is America. New York and LA is not seen as America. I mean, it's like asking a Yorkshireman if he thinks people from London represent his view of Englishness. You know, they don't. They're different breed. But when you go to the middle of Ohio or Massachusetts or Kansas, and what's amazing about those places is that it was a wonderful job, because I would get flown in and I'd arrive, and it was really like being a wedding speaker, because everybody was just there to have a great time. I didn't have to convert anyone to the cause. There would be the biggest audiences were 2,500. But they were probably mostly around 600 to 800, something like that. So, you know, it's a big audience. It's quite fun just to do that stage thing. But they would often turn up in costume. And what I realised was Americans are very, very community-minded. People, I think, are instinctively community-minded. And at a time, you know, Downton came at this funny period in our lives where, first of all, we'd had the recession. It started in 2010, so we were just coming out of the very difficult recession of 2008, 2009. And we were also coming into that period of transition with technology, where this new technology was coming at us very fast, and it was very exciting, but it was this real feeling of, do we embrace this or do we resist it? Is this good for us or is this bad for us? You know, and is it pulling us apart, or, you know, how did it really work? And I think everything was starting to disseminate slightly. And Downton, in the middle of that, just made everyone go, oh, phew, I can just talk about this community of people. And we sort of all ultimately became the villagers of Downton. It's sort of talking about the people in the big house and what they had just done. And then you just saw this relief of these big American groups coming together and just being amongst a few hundred other people who shared some common ground with them. That's what they wanted. And I saw that happen on Twitter, and people just sort of really coming, enjoying that coming together over it. So I loved it. I mean, I just, the more and more that I would find out about the period, the more and more interesting I found it. I mean, I was given 5 years to research it, because the companion books were about the show and how it was made, but they were also really about explaining the context of the series and the real life inspiration that Julian had gone to, whether it was stories from our family or historical events and so on. So I really got, you know, it was essentially a sort of informal PhD in just being able to read all those books and read all the newspaper articles and kind of, you know, I was able to get all that primary source in, and I would never have been able to really spend that time doing that otherwise. And that was really what gave me the foundation for the Mitford murders, which that has meant, although I do a lot of research for the books, I have done 5 years research already.
Yeah, of course. You said doing the speaking thing, you go and kind of do the whole speaking thing. Mm. How do you find, does that come completely naturally to you? Because quite often for writers, it doesn't. Did you have to learn to conquer your nerves, or were you just fine?
I just loved it, which is terrible. Yeah. You know, all these people always say, God, I hate public speaking, it makes me really nervous. And I was going, I really enjoy it. I mean, I do feel nervous in the moment before, but the bits that I always found difficult were more to do with the travel and having to sort of do lots of chit-chatting around at dinners and things beforehand, and sort of meeting lots of people. That was the bit that was slightly exhausting for me, particularly from the hearing point of view, just doing these big dinners and big rounds, and, you know, they always want you to meet 1400 people individually and shake hands with them before you go onto the stage and do your thing. But once I'm actually on the stage, I love it. And I think it's because my mother was an actress and I grew up around a lot of actors, and we, Mum and I, would go to the theatre, Royal Court Theatre in Sloane Square. They used to do £5 tickets on a Monday night, and we'd always go to that. Or she had lots of friends in plays at the Young Vic, and so we always went backstage. And so that whole glamour of the grease paint, and I definitely gave myself those moments. I always request for any kind of public speaking event, like even just sitting to you today, I make sure I'm up in the room 10 minutes beforehand, just to calm and center and think it through. And I don't quite do voice exercises, although I might do if it was a really big event. I did get Viv Groskop, who's an absolutely brilliant fellow podcaster and public speaker. I got her to give me a day of coaching, and she was great. Interesting. You know, just because I think there's always room to improve. She gave me some good exercises to do before doing a big public speaking event that were very helpful. But otherwise, I have to say, it came quite naturally. I'm quite happy not to be doing so much of it now. But I'm really, really pleased I took the opportunity to do it when it was there.
I know you've got another Mitford book out in, I think, November.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what else you've got coming up? I mean, it sounds like quite a lot based on your productivity levels in lockdown. I usually hate asking people that question because, you know, they've just had a book out, and I'm going, well, tell me what else you can, how else can you impress me? But it sounds like you've got quite a lot. So
I'm quite lucky that I've had the discipline of having to produce the Mitford books on an annual basis. You know, it's just been good for me, I think. I keep saying to my husband, sometimes, oh, I think I might take a year off. He said, no, you won't. You know, I need this kind of grist, really. I'm very happy sitting by myself at my desk doing my work. I'm really very happy doing that. So, yes, there'll be a fifth Mitford. The Mitford Vanishing will be out November 2021, which I say slightly appalled because I've got to start writing it. And then the last one, which will feature Deborah Mitford, will be out 2022. And then I've got a novella published in Italy by Mondadori in February called Bella Kate. And
have you written that in Italian?
No, I've written it in English. They translated it, but it's Mondadori Publishing have a crime in print, which they approached me and said I could do anything I wanted to do, which was amazing. So I dug out this novel that I had started writing 7 years ago before the Mitford murders arrived. I thought, this is great, I've written 20,000 words of that. I'll use this, you know, and I sort of put it to one side. When the moment came to start writing it, I looked at it and it was terrible, really bad writing, unusable. And so I thought, so I've got to actually write this from scratch. But I've used the kernel of the story, but I'm actually quite excited about the writing. It's very different to anything that I've done before. So we're sort of currently in the process of selling it into the UK publishing, and then probably around the rest of the world. And then a production company asked me to adapt a memoir into a television series. I've just done the pilot script for that, but I've been doing rewrites and reworking the story outline for that at the moment. And then I'm working on a non-fiction proposal, which I can't say anything about. Sorry, that's really annoying, but that's what's keeping me going. So in the immediate future, there's only really the current Mitford book and then the Bella Kate novella in Italy.
Do you have other unfinished works in your desk drawer that you've started and abandoned?
Well, I never throw anything away. So even if you think it's really appalling, it just goes into a file. I have a big file called Writing in my Dropbox folder, and just there are scraps of things that go back years in there. And I've got a huge box of bits of paper scribbled on that go all the way back probably to when I was 20. And I just think sometimes something comes back to you and you think, oh, actually, that now is the time I think that could make that work. So there's not much... It's not too much in the way of an unfinished work, but there's a lot of plot outlines or story outlines or book ideas, or, you know, that just sort of mull around. I think most things in life are timing. Mm. And if you just, sometimes the time is not right for your particular book to be read by people or appreciated by people. I mean, the classic example I did learn from this was Julian, who wrote his novel Snobs in the mid-1990s. He didn't have enough work on as an actor at the time, and he wrote it in the evenings. He tried to sell it. It didn't sell. At that time, it must have been in 97, the Labour Party had just won by a landslide election, and the very last thing that anybody wanted to read about was posh people trying to get married in 90s London. So he just put it in the drawer. And then when he won his Oscar in 2002, Weidenfeld and Nicholson publishers rang him up and said, we'd really like you to write a novel. We think you could write a good novel. And he said, well, I haven't got time to write a new one, but I have got this one in a drawer. And they got it out and it became a bestseller all around the world. So it hadn't been the right moment before. And probably if it had been published, it might have sunk, and then that would have been the end of it. So I think sometimes you just got to wait it out.
And do you still do that? You'll spontaneously just start something that's of interest and perhaps save it. I mean, what would prompt you to do that?
I'm constantly scribbling bits of ideas down. I mean, the thing that always makes me laugh, I think makes most writers laugh, is when they get asked, where do you get your ideas from? Or when people say, I've got this really great idea for something. You think the ideas are to a penny. I mean, maybe sometimes somebody comes up with a particularly clever crime twist or whatever. Yeah. But on the whole, ideas... You know, if you go off, any of us go off for an hour and just think, I'm just going to try and think of ideas for things. You may not think about them in that hour, but you'll get your brain going. I definitely believe in the subconscious working by itself without, you know, just you've got to let the subconscious do its job sometimes. But tell it what you need to be thinking about. Then give your subconscious time, sleep overnight, and then the next day you'll wake up with the solution to the idea. But the ideas are fine. It's how you... get it out onto the page. That's the bit that makes it work or not. But I did once read that Donna Tartt or Anne Tyler, one of them said that they had a sort of stack of index cards on with character, you know, just vague character ideas. You know, sometimes you see someone and you think, oh yeah, it'd be good to do a character who's always late for things. I must remember to put that in the next novel. And because you never have anybody who's a blueprint. One thing that's always slightly terrifying about giving people close to you your novel is that you think they're going to think they recognise themselves in there, because they'll recognise one aspect of a personality. But yes, you may have given your character that one aspect. That doesn't mean you've said, I'm just going to download this person completely and turn them into that character. You don't do that. They're amalgamations of things. And in fact, the Bella Kate novella I gave to my best friend and said, you do need to be, you know, I'm just by the way, that story that you told me, you know, it's sort of in there, but it isn't really you. And she went, oh, for goodness sake, you know, I understand how it works. Fine. Writer as well. But I love, you know, I do definitely scribble down, not in any very organised way, but I've got a notepad in my bedside drawer. There are things that occur to me last thing at night or first thing in the morning, and I do write them down. That's the other thing. The ideas disappear. You think, oh, I'm never, you're driving along and you have this brilliant solution. You think, I'm never forgetting that.
No.
And then you, 2 minutes later, you've completely forgotten. There was a really great episode of Mad Men where a guy comes up with the best advertising strapline anyone's ever heard ever, and it's going to make him so much money for the in the account. And he gets drunk celebrating, and then of course the next morning he can't remember what the amazing idea was. No matter how hard he tries, it just won't come back to him. And I remember watching that and thinking, oh my god, that's terrifying. I must remember, always write it down.
That's really interesting. I'm gonna let you go because I've taken up quite a lot of your time, and that in itself was pretty good advice. But my final question, which I have given you a sort of ever so slight advanced warning of, because it can be a bit existential, is if you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
It would definitely be to take more risks. And I think I just got a bit serious earlier than I needed to. And, you know, I can't say that there's anything, you know, I'm very happy with where I am. I'm very lucky. There was never any major plan, but I think I could have just taken more risks. I could have just, I really wanted to go and live abroad for a bit, for example, and I didn't do it. I thought I need to knuckle down and do this work. And I think we live a long time now, and my stepkids are 22 and 28. And I'm always saying to them, you know, don't forget, just go and have fun. You know, you really have got time to make mistakes. I mean, I remember when my stepson was 18 or 19 and he was worrying about this decision or that decision. And I said, you know what, you could spend the next 5 years messing up every single thing, everything. Everything can go completely wrong for the next 5 years. You still would be able to recover from that and have a successful life afterwards under whatever terms, you know, you make it. So just don't put yourself under pressure early. And I think I was definitely always that people pleaser girl. I was that little girl who did very well at school and parents thought I was amazing and, you know, tick, tick, tick. And I always achieved things and I did it all even though I was deaf, you know, wasn't that amazing? And it made me really afraid to fail. It made me really frightened of getting something wrong. And I remember saying it to my boss. I got to deputy editor of Country Life magazine or something. I was 30 and I was supposed to be doing something. And I said to my boss, I don't understand. I'm really afraid of doing this thing. I never thought I'd be so afraid. And he said, because you've got further to fall now.
That's interesting.
And I think you have to be wary of that. The truth is that no one is really watching except you. No one really cares except you. And those who love you will be there for you anyway. And if they're not going to be there for you, then they don't love you, and who cares what they think anyway? You know, why are you caring about what people think who you don't like and who, you know, may have no interest, you know? So you do have to do what's right for you, and maybe that's sometimes is you need to get it completely wrong, and who cares? So I, you know, I'm looking forward in some ways. I think that's the challenge I've set myself for the rest of my, for the next few years in my career, is to really try to be a little bit more experimental, be a bit more different, and not worry about fitting into a certain pattern that I've laid out already. So the advice for my younger self is still just as much my advice, the advice for my older self, really.
That's very, very good advice and a fantastic note to end on. Jessica, thank you so much for your time. You've been real joy to speak to, huge fun to speak to. Thank you.
Thank you, Alice.
And to everyone listening, the Mitford trial is out now. So that's it from us. Thank you very much for listening to the Sunday Salon. Please do share your thoughts about the episode with me. I'm on Twitter and Instagram @AliceAzania. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please do think about leaving a review. So until next week, thank you and goodbye.